Merry Christmas, patrons! I'm Fry.
And I'm Bree. And we're not ranking the antipopes today because we're talking about saints. Or at least, we are talking about a saint.
Is it the jolly one?
Well, this is what we're going to discuss. We're going to talk about if he is, in fact, a jolly man.
Ooh.
So yes, this is Saint Nicholas, of course. And no, this will not be another exploration on how Saint Nicholas went from a bishop to the legendary figure of Santa Claus for Christmas, because everyone has already done that to death already. So
it's true.
It's out there. You can find them. That's not what Patreon is for here. We might talk a little bit about some of the stories from his life that are part of why this lore springs up around him, but it's not the purpose of this episode, so we're not going there. Specifically, we are going to deal with what happens when Saint Nicholas attended the Council of Nicaea.
Oh, we haven't even gotten to the Council of Nicaea yet. This is going to be all spoilers for me.
We're getting there really, really soon, and that's where the research is at this point, so it'll come by probably February. We'll be hitting this major, major, major milestone. So, with that in mind, my first question to you, as the raised Catholic and the benefit of Deacon Dad, is what do you know about St. Nicholas? Like, the actual St. Nicholas, not the Santa Claus man guy.
Oh, man, I don't remember an awful lot, honestly. I remember, like, a few of my grade school things had us put out shoes for him on, like, the 8th, maybe?
December 6th.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Close.
Yeah. Okay. So you don't know much about him at all?
No.
Okay. This is going to be fun then. Okay. I'm excited. I was hoping this was not a story that you've heard. So, yay. I am going to give you an accounting of his life as best that we can actually come by it because we need some context for our main event. But with that in mind, pretty much every source that we have on St. Nicholas is a hagiography, which is like the biography of saints' lives. And we know how accurate those are. They like to sprinkle lots of salt and miracles and holiness and fantasticalness and godliness. So there's all that. Bear that in mind. One of the main sources we're going to be using for St. Nicholas comes from St. Methodius of Constantinople from the 9th century. And it's going to get weird. So here we go. So Nicholas was born between 270 and 300 in Patara, Lycia, in Asia Minor.
I have no idea where that is.
Well, I'm going to tell you, because in his lifetime, it would have been a culturally Greek city in the Roman Empire, kind of like that Magna Graecia thing we've been talking about. But today, it is a part of Turkey.
Okay.
And he was the only child to a pair of wealthy, extremely devout Christian parents. And they were either called Epiphanes and Joanna, or Theophanes and Nana.
Those are two different things.
They are so not the same names, but it really depends on what source you read. Either way, he had two very, very rich, very, very devout parents who made a vow to dedicate their son to God.
That is an intense thing to do.
Yeah, well, he's going to live up to it in every way possible. Nicholas is a godly child, like such a ridiculously godly child. So apparently, as a newborn, at the time of his baptism, he stood before the baptismal font.
All right, that seems fake, but okay.
Yeah, stood completely unaided, unsupported, not only this newborn infant standing, but he stood there for 3 hours on his own.
Even I can't stand somewhere for 3 hours. Give me a chair.
Yeah, this infant is doing this to honor the Trinity in the name of which he was to be baptized. Because, you know, that's what infants do.
Miracles.
And that's not it, because apparently he also allegedly would refuse his mother's breast to be fed on Wednesdays and Fridays, according with holy fast days.
No. Babies eat, like, every hour.
Well, he would only accept milk from his mother on those days after the conclusion of their evening prayers. This newborn is holy fasting and standing up for himself.
I hate it.
Let's see if his life choices live up to this godliness, shall we? Now, unfortunately for Nicholas, before we get there, he becomes an orphan quite young when both of his parents die in a disease epidemic, and he gets put into the care of his uncle, who is also called Nicholas, who is the Bishop of Patara at the time. So we dedicate our son to God, and then they die, and so he goes right into the care of the most important bishop in the area.
All right, fair.
Good fit. So this bishop, Nicholas, made young Nicholas his assistant and brought him into the priesthood very early.
What do I do with this baby?
Yeah, I mean, he was a young kind of child slash young man at this point. And he had also inherited the whole of his parents' fortune. So, you know, he's now taken holy orders.
He doesn't get those.
Yeah, ascetic lifestyle. So he uses his substantial wealth to serve the sick and needy. And this is kind of where the Santa Claus stuff starts to come in. He dedicated himself to God and that whole asceticism thing, so he's giving away his material possessions, and he's also said to have paid a lot of special attention to helping children and leaving secret presents like coins in their shoes, and also to ships and sailors who would come and go.
In their shoes?
He would be nice to the sailors, but he would leave coins in the shoes of children.
All right, because only children. It'd just be funny if he got on a boat and started leaving things in people's shoes.
What's that in your shoe? I see something shiny. Ooh.
It's weird for children, but grown adults, it's even weirder.
Well, I mean, he's gonna have a moment with the sailors, so we'll get there. Either way, I mean, no matter how you slice this, he's pretty much the ideal priest. He's living this modest ascetic life, he's serving people who need it most, and he's under the tutelage of his uncle, who's an influential bishop. It really should surprise no one that he moves up in the church quickly, and soon enough he is a bishop himself, and he becomes the Bishop of Myra, which is now called Demre in Turkey. Same province as his hometown Patara, but just a little bit further away. He's now a bishop. But of course, this is the most godly, perfect example, saintly priest Nicholas. So, of course, he's not simply elected to the post of bishop. That would be too simple. That would be too straightforward and realistic.
Does he? I don't know. I don't even know. Does he float there? I have no idea.
Well, so when the previous bishop, John, died, the council who would be selecting the new bishop, they all come together. And they decide that they were going to do things a little bit differently than they normally do, because why not? They felt that the new bishop should be not the choice of men, but rather it was prudent that he be chosen by revelation of God's desire.
We're trying to get a Fabian thing going on here.
Yeah, a little bit. They don't actually put any candidates forward, and they don't do any voting. They just come to this conclusion that, you know what, God will show us the right person, and they go home to bed for the night. While they are sleeping, one of the most senior bishops in the area, he has a vision. And this vision is of a radiant holy man, and this radiant holy man tells him that the first person who enters the church that night should be made the new bishop, for he is the one that has been selected by God. And then also, side note, by the way, that guy who's going to walk into the church, his name's going to be Nicholas. So, you know, just in case some cleaning servants, like, pop in unexpectedly first, it's not those ones. It's the Nicholas guy.
Not on technicality here.
Right, exactly. So, surprise, surprise, when our Nicholas rocks up, he is made the bishop, and it's, you know, the revelation of God.
Sure it is.
Now, as the bishop, Nicholas continues to lead this very ascetic life, and he continues to serve the poor, while allegedly going through Myra to fight evil spirits and destroy idols. So this is kind of where some of his most famous legends pop up, so we're just going to briefly talk about three, because that's perfect and three is clearly his number. So the first legend comes directly from Jacob of Vaugirain's Golden Legend, which we're going to talk about the Golden Legend on and off for our entire series. It's entirely apocryphal, and it's just like one of those legends of the saint things. So when I mention golden legend, don't believe anything I say. So in the first legend, Saint Nicholas becomes aware of a poor man with three dogs,
you said? No.
He becomes aware of a poor man with three daughters, and he can't afford dowries to give his girls good marriages.
Well, I've heard this one.
Yeah. So, like any father, when he can't afford to pay a good dowry, he decides that maybe it's a good idea to sell my daughters into slavery or sex work, because they are burdensome to me. Yeah. So, St. Nicholas starts secretly going to their house at night, and he slips bags of money inside.
That's not weird.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, here's a bag of money. And then they find it the next morning, and he goes, oh, this is wonderful, and he marries off his older daughter. And then the next night, another bag of money, so he arranges a marriage for his second daughter, and so on. So he does this three times so that there's enough money for each of the daughters to get a good marriage, and he tries to do this all in secret. But on the third night, he is seen by the father, who profusely thanks him for his kindness, and Nicholas swears him to secrecy about what happened, like, don't tell anybody what I'm doing. Then there is another legend that he was able to save three innocent men from being executed after they had been condemned to death by a corrupt and bribed governor. In this story, apparently Nicholas literally stopped the execution by going up right as the sword is being held to chop all three men at the same time, and took the sword away from the executioner.
How long is that sword?
Oh, man, some of the image portrayals of this thing is ridiculous. And most of them, he's just, like, holding his hand up at the sword. It's like, they're just gonna chop your hand off.
Is it, like, a long, like, Final Fantasy sword? But why?
I don't know. But this, he gets up there and he whips this sword out of the governor's hand. And somehow, this moves the governor to admit that he's done wrong, and he immediately repents and becomes a Christian, so.
Sure. That's the thing that does it. He must have been teetering quite hard.
Right? So now, the favorite of mine of these three legends, and why I left it for last, suggests that he was able to resurrect three children who had been murdered by an innkeeper. So, apparently, this innkeeper had taken these children, beheaded them, and pickled them in brine.
You know, yuck.
So, and somehow, Nicholas then rocks up and resurrects these children, but
Nicholas came to give some children some money in their shoes, and then they were dead, and he was freaked out.
Their heads were being pickled, and things were not good. But even this one's a little bit too ridiculous for the Saint's Life stories. It's the most discounted, and some people think that it's a misconstrued story from an image of Nicholas with three bags of gold, which, I don't know, maybe looked like children's heads.
Someone drew some lumpy bags.
Yeah, so that would be a really, really big leap to make, but maybe that's what happened somewhere along in the history. So, moving on from the legends, we also need to, like, briefly mention that there are some accounts that say that Nicholas got swept up and imprisoned during the Diocletian persecutions, which we're going to be covering in the main feed on January, so I am not going to say anything more than that other than Nicholas was the mark of Christian morale and exhorted the spirituality of the prisoners and sustained their souls through torture and execution. So that happened, maybe. And then when things changed, he was able to secure a release. And that's all I'm going to say about that. So maybe he went to jail at some point. Maybe it won't be the only time. So with that out of the way, you have your context now. We can get into the meat of this story.
Don't you mean cookies?
I'm trying to think of an adequate food that would be a reference for the story. No, I got nothing. So, okay, this whole thing is super relevant to where we're going in the podcast as a whole. So, St. Nicholas is the Bishop of Myra, as we've said, and as the bishop, he is able to attend the Council of Nicaea in 325, which is the church's first ecumenical council. First in history. So, pretty massive moment in history of Christianity as a whole, And Nicholas is going to make his mark on it, and not in the best of ways. Santa Claus has been naughty.
Oh no, he needs some coal.
Oh yes, yes he will. So, just like we said, this is the church's first ecumenical council, and this is where they get together to discuss actual theology and religious doctrine and various aspects of canon law. And there were a lot of discussions and a lot of debates. And we're not going to cover all of the things that the council did in this, because, spoiler alert, we are going to do a full episode on the main feed just about the council after we talk about that pope, so you're going to get all the details then. And unfortunately, theology is going to be a little bit dry, so we're going to have to, you know, work it up somehow. I've got some ideas. And clearly, I am not the only one who thinks that theology is a little bit dry, because during one of the major debates at the council, St. Nicholas falls asleep.
That's fair.
And during this sleep, he claims that he heard voices calling his name, and that he spiritually projected to a place where he saw sailors clinging to a ship being tossed around in a storm. They're in great danger. Their sails are shredded, the mast is broken, and they are going down. And Nicholas is spiritually projecting himself here, and he raises his hands to bless the sailors, and the water around them immediately calms down. And the sailors are able to regain their control, and they thank God for their rescue, and Nicholas blesses them. And then he returns to people shaking him awake.
That is one real big fever dream there.
It's a really good excuse, too.
Yeah.
Oh, I spiritually projected.
That's going to be my excuse from now on.
So when he actually gets shaken awake, the other bishops say to him, "So much has happened while you slept, Nicholas. We have missed you, brother." So he's getting chided a little bit for this. But genuinely, he says, "Yes, indeed. A ship has been saved and many sailors rescued."
Now he's just speaking nonsense. Cool.
Well, the bishops, who are unaware of his dream or vision or spiritual projection, they thought he meant the church was a ship and that the council had saved the church and its people as sailors. He got some crazy saving throw there, and they all went, "Oh, yes, quite. Mm-hmm. Very wise.
Very good, sir. Mm-hmm." And no one checked him for a stroke.
Yeah, no, not at all. No, they're just like, "Ooh, yes, fantastic." This is only his, like, small naughty story. Now we need to talk about the big naughty story.
Oh yeah, okay.
The main issue that had led to the convening of this council in the first place was, again, the nature of the Holy Trinity.
Mm, yep.
Yeah, so this is to decide what the status of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit was, on their own and then in relation to one another. So we've talked about this. This is an issue that's been dividing the church for a number of years. And the basic form of the debate at this moment was whether or not Jesus, having come from God, begotten by God, was equal to God.
It's a fair argument.
Yeah. So the reason that this is coming to a head is because of a theologian called Arius. And Arius is a Christian ascetic from Egypt, and he'd been preaching that since Jesus was of God, he therefore was not equal to God because he had to be made by God, so therefore he is lesser. And this is known as Arian Christianity, whereas the anti-Arians are vehement believers that God and Christ are one of the same. So with this in mind, Nicholas is a staunch anti-Arian. He is not buying this argument that Jesus is lesser because he was begotten by God or any of these things. This is the big meat and potatoes I come back to of this council. This is what they're there to decide. And Arius is present, and he's defending his viewpoint very, very forcefully, if not even aggressively. Like, he is arguing and he is getting mad. And while he's speaking, other people are getting mad. And Nicholas is getting so mad. He's getting so agitated and fired up at this man's heresy, and he can't handle it anymore. In his mind, the very essence of Christian religion is being attacked. And so he gets up, and he strides across the room, and he decks Arius right in the face.
Yeah, priest fight.
Santa Claus has full-on punched somebody at the most solemn religious council to have ever been called.
You know,
And everyone present is stunned and appalled, and nobody expected that. So Nicholas gets dragged out of the meeting by the enraged bishops, and they bring him to the emperor to inform him of what happened. And the emperor confirmed that it was absolutely illegal to strike anyone at a religious council, let alone in his presence. And so the outburst needs to be punished.
This is just a rule he made up right then.
Yep. He's the emperor. He can do whatever he wants. He's, we're going to get into all of that, but we're talking about Emperor Constantine here. So he's now like jumping full bore into Christianity, and they're going, whatever you say. So he says, yeah, you need to punish this guy. But he says, I'm leaving it up to you guys to determine what the punishment is. I'm not going to step in here. You guys have to decide that for yourself. So the bishops, they decide that this is just absolutely outrageous, and they strip him of his bishopric.
Wow, that is, I'm sorry.
Bishop no more. And they literally, like, they take his bishop vestment, which is called an omophorion, right off of his body. They take away his personal copy of the Gospels, and they throw his ass in jail.
That is such an intense reaction.
And, you know, he's going to be in jail, so he's going to miss out on the rest of the discussions, and they're not done with him. They're just like, you just need to stay here until we can decide what else we want to do with you.
They could give him a gentler time out.
Yeah, no, they're full ready to go, like, full on. They're going to double down. So now Nicholas is in jail, and he's stripped of his vestments.
Defrocked.
Yeah, he's been defrocked, laicized, and he is, realizing that maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. He's a little bit ashamed.
He had some blood going.
Yeah, and he still feels like his intentions were good. He was strong in his anti-Arian convictions, and so he starts praying, and he prays for forgiveness. And then a miracle happens.
Miracles.
He has a vision where the Virgin Mary and Christ both come to him. And when they ask him, why are you in prison? His response is, because I love you, my Lord and God. And Mary and Christ are moved by this, and they bless him, and they absolve him of his guilt, and they provide him with a new bishop's robe, and then they unchain him, and they leave. Because, you know, Jesus and Mary are cool when you punch people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jesus flips tables.
I punched him because I love you.
Yeah, Jesus flips tables because he loves God, so I mean.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's why they're on board. So when the jailer comes the next morning, Nicholas is out of his chains. He's dressed in robes that he absolutely had not had, and now he's patiently and quietly reading scripture, acting like a goodly priest again. So they pull him out of there and they bring him back towards the emperor, and they tell him what's happened. Okay, like, obviously there's been a miracle. And he goes, yeah, okay, so Nicholas should be reinstated to his bishopric. And in the end, it really didn't matter that he wasn't a part of the discussion of the council anyways, because the council ultimately settles on the Nicene Creed, which declares that from that point on, Christianity is anti-Arian. That's all we need to know for now. Of course, we have to follow through with the next statement that always comes after this type of story, which is, historians argue that this is not true and never happened.
Of course.
Of course. So, we have an article by Stephen Graydanus titled, Let's Stop Celebrating St. Nicholas Punching Arius. And he explains why historians argue that maybe this didn't happen. The first is that many sources that list the attendees of the Council of Nicaea don't actually have St. Nicholas on them. He might not have actually been there at all. I've seen lists where he is included, so, you know, some say they do, some say they don't.
The lists are very bad from back then.
So bad. Never fully, that just because you're not on a list doesn't mean you weren't there, but that's one reason that it could be untrue. The other is that the first accounts of this story of St. Nicholas punching Arius at the council doesn't really show up until the 1300s, which is 1,000 years after the actual council. So this is always a reason to be suspect of the sources. You know, the longer a story shows up after the time it allegedly happened in, the less reliable it is.
So this is some fan fiction alternate universe where St. Nicholas punched some guy.
Entirely possible.
There's also a coffee shop version.
Point number three on this is, if it actually happened, the medieval sources, the ones from the 1300s, don't say punch, they say slap. So maybe we should be arguing that he's trying to just slap him back into his senses and not to hurt him, because somehow that's different.
I've watched several episodes of Jerry Springer, and the slaps are always worse.
I used to love Jerry Springer when I was a kid. I remember being at home from school because I was sick. I think I had maybe like pink eye or something, and I just watched Jerry Springer all day. But coming back to this, Stephen Gray Dannis also wants to make the final point that why would Mary and Christ show up to validate an action of physical violence as a mean to get things done in the Catholic Church? That's so anti-Catholic of them. But is it?
I don't know what Mary and Jesus they've been hanging out with, but...
I mean, like, violence seems a pretty common calling card for the Catholic Church. I'm gonna say I don't buy that one. But either way, I mean, it's a great story. There's no way we couldn't tell this story. Santa Claus punched somebody at the face at the Council of Nicaea. That is amazing.
It's a good story.
So we're gonna wrap up this episode a little bit just with, you know, what happened in the rest of his life and sainthood, because that's what we talk about. So after this event, Nicholas was actually able to remain the Bishop of Myra, and he gets to die peacefully on December 6th, 343, which is why his shoe day is December 6th. He gets buried in the cathedral in Myra, and he is there until 1087 when his relics get transferred to Bari in the south of Italy due to an invasion of Muslims in the area. As per usual, they dig up the important people and they move them on, and Pope Urban II would preside over the new enshrinement of his relics at Bari in the south of Italy. And of course, because he's St. Nicholas, his gravesite becomes the site of miracles, including the production of a healing manna, which fosters a cult of devotion to him, and he is canonized. And the anniversary of his death is now celebrated as his feast day. And of course, he's become Santa Claus. He is a saint. Feast day, December 6th. He is a patron saint of travelers and children and deliverance from bonds, poverty, and misfortune. Because, you know, he knows how to get out of that. And we're going to end this episode on a final note about his relic. From 2017.
That's last year.
This man who lived so long ago. In 2017, a team from the University of Oxford radiocarbon dated a fragment of pelvic bone that allegedly belonged to St. Nicholas. It was owned by an American priest, and he decided maybe it's time to get this tested and make sure that what I think I have is what I have. So the test confirmed that the bone fragment accurately could be dated to the era of St. Nicholas. And so now that they've tested this and gotten a positive affirmation of time, they are hoping to match the bone to the others that are currently in Bari at his shrine to verifiably link them as belonging to St. Nicholas. That's pretty cool.
That is actually pretty cool.
When we radiocarbon date stuff, usually it's fake. So it's pretty cool to hear that, hey, maybe this one is real. So there we go. This is the story of St. Nicholas sans all the Santa Claus stuff. So what do you think of this guy?
He's fine.
I love that he's punching people at the council.
Yeah.
If he's resurrecting beheaded pickled children, I'm all on board for that.
That's something that you should do if you can.
I'm waiting for the moment where, because it always looks like Pope Francis is going to fall asleep during his general audiences, that he wakes up and goes, oh, I spiritually projected.
I spiritually projected and saved a boat from sinking.
And everyone will go, oh, yes, yes you did. Ooh, very wise.
Not checking in for a stroke or anything.
Well, on that note, thank you, patrons, for listening up and supporting us in our first year of podcasting. The next time you hear us will be in 2019, and that is so cool and so crazy. So I hope you had a wonderful Christmas, and if you still have family get-togethers, You can tell them this story about Santa Claus. I'm sure they'll appreciate it.
Most people do something for New Year's.
Yeah, tell them about how Santa Claus punched people in the face. Cool.
Maybe reenact it. No, don't do that.
Especially at a New Year's party. That seems like a bad idea. So, with that we say thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.